All right, this is Roger Ridley Pryor with another of the Imagining Philadelphia's Energy Futures interviews. I'm here with Adam Garber. Today is August 7th, 2017. We are at 1429 Walnut Street. And Adam, would you mind spelling your last name?
Garber, G-A-R-B as in boy, E-R.
Great. Adam, when were you born?
I was born in 1983 in Atlanta, Georgia.
Atlanta.
Piedmont Hospital.
Huh. Had your family lived around Atlanta for a while?
Yeah, I'm a third generation Atlantan. My parents were both born and raised there. And my grandparents all moved to Atlanta, at the early 20th century with their families from different places.
Why?
There's actually a really large Jewish community in Atlanta. So part of it, I think, was that. Atlanta actually has one of the larger Jewish communities outside of New York City. And it has forever, and I don't really know why that is. It seems weird.
Right on.
So I think they moved there partially because of the Jewish community. And then just sort of a weird set of different, I think, reasons. Like my dad's father, his dad was a wandering, eyeglass maker, optician. Huh. So I had like a wagon that went town to town. And they lived in Atlanta, and then he grew up actually in the Jewish orphanage home there. His mom had tuberculosis. His dad passed away.
Hmm.
My grandma on that side moved from like Norfolk. My other grandma moved from North Dakota.
Wow, all over.
Like my grandfather and my mom's side moved from New York, from Brooklyn.
Huh.
So sort of all over. But they all actually came from Poland-Russia area, sort of along the border, basically. It sort of never knew each other, but they're all basically from the Poland-Russia area.
Interesting. And were they all part of that wave of immigration from the 1880s kind of thing?
Yeah, I think so. They were all part of sort of the Jewish immigration. I don't know, there's not a lot of family history, but I'm guessing because of pogroms and other things like that, they sort of left. But before the World Wars, before World War II, I think some after World War I, some before, mostly before World War I.
What are your parents' names?
Marian and Stephen.
How did Marian and Stephen meet?
That is a good question. See, now this is going to really stump me. I'm going to be troublous. They met in grad school. They work in sort of similar fields, both dealing with kids, educational needs. My dad's a psychologist. My mom's an education consultant. They both had their PhDs. I think they met at some party or something originally. There's some story about my dad's roommate saying my dad wasn't going to ask her out, he was. Some funny story about that. And they were at, I think in grad school. My dad was in grad school at Georgia State. He went to undergrad, actually, University of Pennsylvania.
Oh.
My mom went to Washington University undergrad, and then she was a teacher afterwards, and then eventually got her PhD.
And they were both down getting their degrees at Georgia State.
My dad was, and I guess my mom wasn't. Maybe she was a teacher at the time. She actually went back to school after my dad got his PhD.
She's like, it's my turn.
yeah. After she helped, helped him, his back went out at some point, and so she ended up typing most of his thesis during dictation in the old days. So it definitely was her turn.
That's awesome. Do you have other siblings?
Yeah, I have three sisters. A little bit like Goldilocks. I have an older sister who lives in New Jersey. I have a twin sister who lives in Brooklyn, and I have a little sister who still lives in Atlanta.
You have a twin sister?
Yeah.
Wow. So, okay, and so you were born into that mix. So it was the older sister, you and your sister twins, and then the youngest.
Yeah, so there's about, my older sister's 7 years older than me, my little sister's 9 years younger than me.
Wow.
So it's a pretty big spread.
Yeah, 11 years older and 9 younger. All right. Did you grow up in Atlanta?
Yeah, I grew up, I lived there, till I went to college, and mostly, in the summers through college.
Huh. Tell me about, what are some of your memories of growing up?
Memories of growing up.
You and your sister always in the same room? Were you guys putting matching outfits all the time?
It wasn't that bad. I remember when we moved into the new house, we lived in the same house since I was about 2. And I clearly remember the day we no longer were in the same bedroom. We were in the new house, and my room was ready for me to move into, and they moved me out, and I was very upset. because I couldn't share a room with my sister anymore.
At 2 years old, you remember this?
Yeah. I mean, some memory slash probably been told the story 50,000 times. probably the scientist would say, you don't really remember that. You just heard the story too many times. So I remember that. I mean, and then we all lived in one house. So we lived there since, my parents still live there. So we've always lived in, basically since we were two in the same house. We all had our own bedrooms. This is pretty, upper middle class neighborhood. It's, inside the perimeter in Atlanta. It's technically not part of the city anymore because it's seceded. It's called Sandy Springs.
It's seceded.
Yeah, it's very bitter. Mm-hmm. Fight. It's a neighborhood within the perimeter, but sort of on the outer edges, so it feels like suburbia almost, or what you would think of suburbia for Philadelphia. So very, green, lots of woods, yards. It's not a McMansion. It's it was originally a farmhouse, actually.
Oh, wow.
And it was converted into this sort of modern house in the, there's probably 20 houses on our block, I think, or something.
Wow.
But it's pretty wooded, pretty spread out, not walkable. I do remember though, as a kid always, we used to walk, there's a park about probably a mile and a half, 2 miles away. And as a kid, we'd walk to the park, Chastain. We'd get ice cream at the park and wander around the park. But it's sort of weird because there's, and I think we wouldn't do it anymore because there's no sidewalk. It's pretty hilly. And these days people go flying down those streets. So now I wonder, why would we be allowed to do that? Why was that ever safe? But we used to walk to the park from the house, about 2 miles.
Now when you say we, so what are your sister's names?
My sisters are Ariel's my twin, Amy's my older sister, and Aubrey's my little sister. So all A's.
Yeah. And Auburn, did you say?
Aubrey.
Cool.
Yeah.
So when you say we used to walk, was that you and Ariel or Amy involved in that too? Or
it was mostly me and Ariel and either our parents or we had a housekeeper, Dar, who's been with us since I was also one and a half.
Did she help raise you?
Yep.
What's her name?
Doris.
Doris, awesome.
And she helped raise us and still with us. And she, usually my parents or Dars would walk down during, after you got home from pre-K or on the weekend she wasn't around, so that would be mom and dad. We'd walk to the park and get ice cream and whatever else.
Yeah. That sounds like a pretty idyllic, bucolic kind of childhood.
It was. I mean, I think I was pretty lucky and pretty blessed. And when you think about childhood, it's sort of notable. I grew up, my grandfather, Papa Al, was, as I said earlier, he grew up in an orphanage, Jewish orphan home. And he was very successful and a very successful businessman. And I think sort of would talk a lot about what it was like growing up. But then we had this very different experience, obviously, of everything, just totally anything you needed, basically, which I feel blessed to have had, but was very different than a lot of people.
Was your grandfather like, we used to walk 20 ways uphill, both, that sort of stuff?
A little bit of that, more just trying anything to remind us that, we were lucky, and he was really lucky, actually. I mean, he got a fake scholarship to college, essentially.
What does that mean?
He got an athletic scholarship to college. He was not an athlete. The headmaster of the school he went to knew he wouldn't be able to afford to go to Georgia State and had an athletic scholarship he could just give out and gave it to him so he could go. And he turned into a very successful accountant and businessman and owned a lot of stuff in Atlanta. Did accounting for the entire Jewish community, as far as I can tell.
Wow.
But it was this lucky thing. And so he'd often talk about both what it was like and then there are just these things that happened that would have probably been ended up maybe very differently.
Hmm. It sounds to me like the Jewish community was a strong part of your experience growing up.
We'd go to synagogue every Saturday. We were always extremely involved in the synagogue. Go to Saturday school, there were twice weekly after school classes, so Mondays and Wednesdays, I think, maybe, or Tuesdays and Thursdays, twice a week.
That's
Hebrew
a lot
lessons.
Of time, yeah.
Yeah. So twice a week you'd go, three times a week essentially, you'd go to synagogue services, which there were kids' services and lessons on Saturday, and then twice a week you'd mostly go in the afternoons. We didn't go to, I went to a Protestant private school.
For high school?
For middle school, high school, elementary school.
Oh, wow. Why?
It is a very good school, and the public schools in Atlanta are not very good. Mm-hmm. And I think my parents wanted us to have a very good education, and so we all went to different... Well, my sister and I started there, and then Ariel went to a different school for high school. And then my older sister and my little sister also went to different private schools. My little sister went to a Jewish day school, and my older sister went to another private school called Woodward. Yeah, I think just, like, the schools weren't very good at the mm-hmm. time. And really, where we lived, they weren't the best. They're better, actually, now. Mm-hmm. But then we'd go to Jewish school.
Why did you and your Ariel go to different high schools?
She wanted to go to a different high school.
Just different experience?
Yeah, Westminster is, it's a preparatory school, and it's little, I think it's different now from what I know, but it's a little bit of a pressure cooker, it's like a little, like, very focused on the, you know, like, instead of those things that you sort of know about those private schools, I don't know how to describe it, that I think, that and a set of other things sort of, at some point, she was looking for something different. So she ended up going to the American International School and had a really great time there.
Did you enjoy being at Westminster? Was that a place where you thrived?
It was a mixed bag. It was like a mixed bag. I had a set of really close friends, and I'm still close with a set of them today. And I had a set of activities I did, like debate. I was on the debate team. And there were some really great teachers there, but it was also a real challenge at times. Because of the nature of the school, and at times because it was a Christian school, I had some really bad experiences over the years.
You mean like being oppressed for being Jewish?
Yeah. There's like two memories that stick out. One is in middle school, there was a rabbi teaching a math class, Rabbi Eaglitz. Anyway, he was teaching a math class, and a bunch of the teachers, technically, you had to be Christian to teach at the school, which doesn't really have anything to do with math, and a bunch of the parents got really upset about it, and they got him, I think, fired, and then a bunch of other parents revolted over it, including my own, and said, look, you know, this doesn't have to do with religion, he's teaching math, he's not teaching his New Testament, Old Testament, whatever. So that was really rough.
What came from that?
They mostly stopped enforcing the policy, I think, around, like, the teachers being Christian unless they were related to the course. So there's a ninth grade, maybe it was, you took an Old Testament course, mm-hmm. ninth or tenth grade, and then 12th grade, you took a New Testament course. And I think those turned out really well. I had really good teachers for them. I had a teacher who taught Hebrew, for the Old Testament course.
Cool.
And that made it really easy because I already knew it. And then there was the New Testament teacher was actually a former reverend, but he was like very open, and we had a very mixed class of folks who were born-agains, we had a Wiccan, we had an atheist, we had some Jews, we had, I think, a Hindu. It was like a weird, like, somehow just fell together, and he was very open to thinking of the New Testament as like a literary document, so that worked out pretty well. Mm-hmm. But my junior year, I think it was, there was a Christian Emphasis Week. There's yearly Christian Emphasis Weeks, and they decided to change it to Religious Emphasis Week for the year to try to be more ecumenical. And the first speaker was from Emory University. She's the chaplain at Emory, so pretty well known in the area, you know, pretty good religious school at Emory. And she talked about universalism and being accepting of other people. And, you know, during the Q&A period, this guy who ran the like Christian fellowship on campus got up and started spouting like John 3:14 or whatever, and you know, all this stuff about if you don't take in Jesus Christ you're going to hell, basically. And she literally left the stage in tears. I mean, they were really harsh to her. And then when we were going, you had a like hour afterwards, you could go to study hall or you could go to a study group, and the same guy who I knew, he came and he said, you know, Adam.
To you.
Yeah, he saw me as we were going into one of the buildings, and he said, you should come to my study group. You can be saved. Otherwise, you're going to go to hell. And I said something like, you know, if I said something like, Jesus is Jewish, so at least I'll be in hell with him. And then I went to a different study group with my friend who was also an Orthodox Jew, actually, which was a pretty good one. But it was like, you know, but that day, actually, like a third of the people in my class told me I was going to hell.
Wow.
Basically, like, nicely told me I was going to hell. And I've known many of these people since I was like 10, 8, 9. And it was sort of this like astounding moment, like, you've grown up with me. Why would you just, you know? And they're like, it's nothing about you. It's just, you're Jewish. So that was a shocking moment, I think, you know.
How did you internalize those things as a child? Or as a young man at that point?
How did I internalize those things? I mean, I think the thing I ended up really appreciating was there's just this small cluster of people who didn't think that way, adults and sort of this ideal that there are like these fundamentalists in the world that have like this really extreme view, but that a large chunk I think don't. And then I probably still haven't totally understood, like, why did people who I grew up with since I was 8 or 9 suddenly think, and like on this day, why not just like say, I don't want to be hang out with you or whatever. But to be honest, this stuff happened in Georgia sort of regularly, so it's sort of interesting, and I don't know if it's that different, but
it happened to you in Georgia?
Yeah, I mean, in different ways. Like, you always knew you were a little bit as a Jew in the South, like a little bit of an outcast. So, like, my best friend, Jamie, we went with his Christian, he was in that Christian group, and we went to play Capture the Flag one weekend at, like, some camp in the middle of nowhere. And it was supposed to capture the flag, and I was like, oh yeah, that seems like fun, whatever. And it's not, you know, it's the Christian group, but it's just going to be capture the flag overnight, camping out and whatever. So that seems fun. So we got in trouble for playing capture the flag too loud. And so we ended up having like a fire and hanging out. And then they were all born agains, and or a bunch of them were, and they found out I wasn't Christian. And they spent like 3 hours trying to convert me, which my friend Jamie found hilarious because like we've been friends forever and he's not like that and whatever, but he just sort of thought it was hilarious to watch, you know? So that like, you sort of feel like, okay, suddenly it's like a big deal. Or like, grew up, I heard stories of my grandfather growing up. There was a Jewish country club called the Standard Club, but there were 3 well-known Christian country clubs. And my grandfather in the business community was asked to go play poker. I mean, these are like the stories you hear. So like, was asked to go play poker at the Peachtree Club, which was Christian only. And he said, well, I can't go in, it's Christian only. He said, oh, it's okay, you can, one of his friends said, oh, it's okay, you can come in the back door. And so, you know, like, you grow up in this thing of like, it's not, I think it's not as overt as racism can be in the same way, because it's not as obvious, right? And it's not, maybe it's not as bad as it is today. There's this weird thing where you're always, there are moments where you sort of knew, oh, I'm not quite like everyone else. Mm-hmm. I do am kind of different, and there will always be this thing, and, you know, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
So.
I guess I keep thinking, like, what does that mean for you? Was that something you then relied more internally on your family? You and your family grew closer, or you just kind of knew who you,
I think
you knew who you could know and could love you that way?
I think I look for people that didn't think that way. So, you know, on, including Jews who I think sometimes can, you know, sort of be very insular at times, in the Jewish community, and people that sort of were just, sometimes less religious or more just like open and didn't care that much about it. I don't have a ton of really close Jewish friends. But at the same time, I think my Judaism's become pretty important to me. So like, my wife and I don't have kids, but we've said sort of when we have kids, they will go to synagogue, they will be raised Jewish. She's not Jewish, but that's fine. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think that's become, being Jewish is therefore like part of your identity. And in some ways, Judaism is partially religion and partially identity. And mm-hmm. so it's a little different than I think Christianity is in some ways. But
yeah. Has the religious aspect been something that was important to you then? Or is that something that's grown since?
It comes and goes. It's like in, sort of comes and goes.
At when?
I don't know. Like in college, like when everyone else would go partying on Friday nights, I went to synagogue, for like 3 years straight.
Why?
Partially I found a really great synagogue I really liked,
yeah.
In Annapolis where I went to school. And, partially I just think it was, I was looking for something a little different from the school. There weren't a lot of Jews at the school, small school. And there wasn't a lot of Jewish connection. So I think it just was like, oh, I need some still connection to my Jewish community. But I don't go to synagogue regularly here, so, you know, on the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know exactly what makes it comes and go.
Yeah. Can you talk to me a little bit about what it's like growing up as a twin, and as you're growing up into becoming a man, and a sense of who you are as a self, as an individual, and yet you have this twin sister who you've shared so much of your life with. Is that something that was challenging? Was that a benefit? What was it like being a twin?
Well, I think when you have a twin who's fraternal, it's probably more like just having another sibling. Mm. At least for us, I think it was. So we didn't, we weren't that close growing up. We got along fine, but we weren't like close. We didn't do the same things. We didn't have the same friends. We didn't hang out that much. It wasn't really till like after college probably that we got closer.
Really?
Yeah. And so I think... there weren't a lot of times, you know, we had to do like we did a b'nai mitzvah together, and we're sort
What's it called when you
have... a b'nai mitzvah is when you have, when you have a boy and a girl together.
Yeah.
It's just the plural.
I've never heard it. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And we, you know, so there were things like that, but I think on a like daily, weekly, I don't know, yearly basis, I don't really remember thinking of it different than having, you know,
Just another sister,
you know, and I think probably also some of that may relate to the fact that we were pretty financially stable and blessed, and so, you know, there wasn't a lot of tension around, like, oh, she got this thing, or, she, you know, whatever, right? It didn't, you didn't have that stuff happen. Mm-hmm. But we're pretty close now. She's got a little girl, mm-hmm. So I'm going up in a few weeks for the baby naming. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's also a new little, you're a new uncle.
Zadie, yes, I'm a new uncle, second time being an uncle. I have a twin. My older sister has twins.
Oh, my goodness.
We're about five, so.
Wow. Yeah, that runs in the family, doesn't it?
Oh, God, let's hope not.
You mentioned that your debate team was something you were involved in. Can you tell me a little bit about what that experience was for you?
I got involved in middle school with the debate team, and I continued through high school with it. There were probably about 10 to 12 of us, and actually became pretty nationally competitive. So did a lot of traveling to national tournaments for it, which was really interesting. Spent the summers like going to camp for it and meeting people. So it sort of became a big part of like the equivalent of, I don't know, a sports thing or something.
Yeah.
So pretty close friends from it. And then, you know, it's, yeah, it was like, I really enjoyed it in the moment, and I learned a lot from it. You know, you're like reading a lot of history and philosophy, and I think, you know, sort of, I like to read, so it really like worked for me in that way. And then there's like, in retrospect, there's like weird things about debate that like the way it works, that's like a little bit of like the artifice of just making an argument versus actually believing the thing, just sort of different than what I do today. So it's like, you know, a little interesting to think about in reverse of like, oh, you're just trying to make an argument, whether you really think it holds merit or not. Just make the best argument you can versus, which I think I realized at some point in college, I wasn't on the debate team anymore, that like, oh, there's this weird thing happening. It's not about what you believe. It's just that argument. And so that, I think in the end, I sort of made me realize, like, I didn't want to do something like that. Like, I didn't want to become a lawyer who's just trying to make the argument or something like that,
I think. Interesting. Tell me, and the work that you do today,
yeah.
Tell me about how you see that work.
I mean, mostly I see it as like, it is not a work or not a job. Like, it is what I believe. So I work for an environmental nonprofit in Philadelphia, Penn Environment. And I've worked here for about 10 years. I think of it as like part of who you are. So I think of like, it is like, okay. I mean, mostly that I tell people, like when I talk to our members or something, as I tell them, like, I'm blessed because I get to do something I believe every day. And I get to get paid for it and make a living out of it. That seems like the best of all worlds, right? And so it's like fighting for what you believe in. And luckily, you get to make a career out of it. So beyond that, like, what else could you ask for in the world?
That's a pretty great thing.
Yeah.
But debate team at the time was, it seems like a social
community. Yeah, it was a social community. It was an educational community. So probably the first time I ever read, like, Heidegger and Kant, which I read in college. I studied philosophy. You know, a lot of reading of the news, or reading current events, which I do today, obviously, thinking about how the political system works, which I did a lot of in college, and obviously do now in my daily job in a nonprofit advocacy world. So I think probably in the end, probably gave me a lot of initial exposure to those different things that then became things I delved into deeper as time went on.
So you went to a preparatory school in Atlanta, and it was clearly preparing you to go to college. That was,
it
sounds like an assumed thing with two parents with PhDs.
Yeah. Yes, you better go to college at that point. I think that's true.
Yes. So where were you thinking in high school? Where were you thinking you wanted to go? What kind of school were you interested in?
Yeah, I was trying to find a school that was actually basically the opposite of Westminster. So something that wasn't about preparing you for the next step in life. What I found was I really loved learning. I really loved like investigating things and diving in deeper. And I didn't really care always what the purpose was, right? So like Westminster, it was all like a purpose, right? Get good grades, learn the things you need to know so you can go to a good college, you can get a good job, so you can do whatever. And then I really didn't like that thing. But what I did like was I loved learning. So I loved studying and I loved reading and I loved all that stuff. And so looking for a school that was like sort of the opposite. So I looked at a lot of small liberal arts schools with sort of alternative, sometimes systems. So I looked at Hampshire College, which is it's a create your own major school. I think in Boston, Massachusetts, somewhere. Mm-hmm. Hamilton, which is a little more traditional, but in upstate New York. And then I ended up looking at this place called St. John's College in Annapolis, Maryland. Which is based on the Great Books program. So it's all based on reading the great books of the Western world, from Plato and Aristotle to Heidegger and Kant, and in all the subjects, so whether it's philosophy or in biology, starting with Galen and moving through Harvey, you sort of name it. Physics, read the Principia, did all the proofs in the Principia,
wow.
Sort of all that stuff. And so went to this, to have a conversation. We did like a big trip as a family, right? So it was me, my mom, my dad, and my sister, right? So we picked a bunch of schools in Boston, in the Washington, D.C., basically, area.
Yeah. Did your sister have different ideas of what she wanted from college? You sound like you were very clear on what you wanted.
I think she did. She was looking for like a bigger school, a little bit medium-sized. She was looking, I think, for a place that had a bunch of different options. She didn't really know, I think, what she was looking for in some ways. She ended up changing majors a bunch of times, which worked out well first. So she did architecture and art history and something else. So she went to University of Washington in St. Louis.
Oh, where your mom went.
Yeah, this is the case may be. And she really loved it. She had a great time. She met her husband there. She had a wonderful, amazing time. And I think, worked really well for her. But I think looking for something with more of those options, but not like a massive state school or something and not,
So you went on this family trip to go explore the Eastern Coast schools.
Yeah, we sort of did it as like, let's just go explore 20 different schools, not even the schools you're going to really look at, but 20 different schools with different things, right? So small schools, big schools. So we did like UMass and we did, American and George Washington and let's go look at a bunch of different types of schools to help you figure out. I think was smart of my parents of like, then you'll know what you're looking for and what you like and you don't like. And then we can look across the country to figure out, what sort of things, right? So I thought that was really smart of them. And we went to this school, St. John's, which I think my guidance counselor recommended. I think Mr. Boggs recommended it. We met the the admissions guy, and we sat and we started talking and talking about the school. And we like literally almost met, like I was so fascinated in love with the school, and my dad was so fascinated in love with the school. I think he wanted to go, and we almost missed our flight home. And I got home, and it turned out that I just had to go. And so it was rolling admissions. I went a few weeks later for like a prospective weekend. And I remember going to the restroom at 3 a.m. And I walked out of the room and at 3 a.m. and there are these two guys who I met years later, Augustine and Micah. And they were sitting in the hallway at like, 2, 3 a.m. arguing what happens if you get rid of Euclid's book 5, proposition 4, whatever it was. And what happens to the whole scheme? I can't remember what it was now. I was like, oh, these people are just arguing about math theory at like 2 a.m. in a hallway, and that's what they think is fun. That seems awesome.
Those are your people.
Those are my people, right? And so I went home. I wrote 20 pages of essays in 2 weeks. It was very intensive essay writing. Sent it off, got in October, and I was accepted, and I was like, I'm going, and that was that. And
awesome.
Senior year was easy.
You knew what you were doing.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So tell me about that experience in college. Was it what you imagined it was going to be?
It was. And it was totally what I imagined it to be, is people having deep discussions and debates about all sorts of, you know, basically about the liberal arts, math, science, philosophy, literature, classics, right, you name it, and thinking through together, you know, how you know, what those mean about the world. And also it was learning how to think. So it was like, we had to learn ancient Greek in 6 months. You do that, everything else is easy. We had to figure out how, you know, we read Einstein. We had to figure out, redo his proofs. And he likes to skip a lot of steps, unfortunately, for everyone. So you figure out Einstein, you're like, okay, I got it. So it was all that thing. And then the thing that was sort of interesting about it was, I wasn't political at all. And I got a... And the one thing it wasn't is it wasn't a political school. And actually, there was like a strain of like, don't be involved in the world while you're in college, which is really unusual for college, right? That's a lot of times people get politicized.
Yeah.
And I ended up getting a job canvassing my first summer in college in Georgia for Georgia Perg on air quality issues. And I became politicized. And I got sort of over the following 3 years, as I continued to do political work and advocacy on environmental and other issues on the side, you know, with some groups at school and on the side, I got more and more frustrated because it was like, sort of like, don't do this while you're at school.
Hmm.
So that was the one thing. And I would have never thought that going in. And it was this other experience that just totally like changed it a little bit. So I still love the school and I really like, so glad I went. And then there's just this one piece that was really missing for me.
So you began that to work with Georgia Perg on air quality issues, your freshman, summer of your freshman year. As your schooling continued, the rest of your years of undergrad, was that something that was like kind of angsty? Was that something that was like you were pushing for something different from the way the school worked?
Well,
or was
at times,
summertime was the time to be politicized.
I did some stuff at school, and there were some angsty, for lack, I don't know if angsty, but I'm not the angsty person, but you know, moments. So I did some environmental organizing on campus, and I did a ton of anti-war organizing. So this was in the lead up to the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm. And what years were you in college?
So I was at school from 2001 to 2005.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was lead up to the Iraq War. It was like my sophomore really year. And maybe beginning of junior year is when we went to war, I guess, somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm.
I just had to find other avenues for it mostly. And then every once in a while when it came to campus, so like when I tried to do some petitioning on campus or something, there was something that happens that felt a little like, oh, these people don't get me or something. Like, mm-hmm. So in that sense, like I remember petitioning and someone telling me that Kant's categorical imperative meant they couldn't sign my petition about recycling. It's like, what are you talking about? It's a recycling petition, you know? But it's like, just like sort of pretentious-y, like, oh, we're just going to think about the world answer. But mostly then I just did it. I did more in the summer for sure. And then when I was on campus, I did like some of it, but I did usually through off-campus mechanisms or things like that.
Mm. In what ways? What was the things you did?
So I was pretty involved. So after the canvas, I was involved with a group called Free the Planet that did a bunch of work on college campuses around getting corporations to clean up their environmental policies by pressuring them. So I did some work with that, and then I did a ton on anti-war stuff. There was a bunch of anti-war groups. There's an anti-war group on campus, and then I got involved with the Maryland Anti-War Coalition, whatever the statewide student coalition was against the war, and did a bunch of marches and organized a bunch of protests. And I had a good friend who was also pretty politically involved, so we did a bunch of marches and rallies and protests sophomore, junior year together.
Would you go down to D.C.? You were so close.
Yeah, we'd go to D.C. for the protests. We'd bring like a carload of people or two. We'd like, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So enough to like have that outlet at least, even if it wasn't like a full-time thing. Like you might find at like another bigger school or school that was a little more political.
Hmm. That's some of the things that stood out to me as you were talking about your college experience was thinking through things together. And is that something you still, it seems like that was important to you in debate team in high school, it was important to you in college. Is that still something that resonates with you now?
Yeah, I think on all this stuff, it's like whether it's the theory, like trying to figure out Kant, or if it's like the politics today, like they're big problems, they're complicated, and I don't think one person can solve them or like figure out the solution or the best way forward. So I think like having sort of the argument of different people and coming to some joint resolution is important. And listening to people, and then hopefully the best concept either percolates to the top, or if you can't totally figure it out, let's figure it out together. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the stuff in school was like, you know, doing that all as a team, because it's sort of like the other thing to know about St. John's is the professors don't really know. So the professors have to teach all the subjects. So like my freshman year, Mr. Smith, he got his PhD in Montaigne, but he was teaching our lab course, which was mostly biology freshman year. He knows nothing about biology. So, you know, like, but he had to figure his way through it. And so it's sort of this just collaborative learning. And yeah, he knows a little bit more because he preps ahead of time. But like, of just like, there's not necessarily, just because you're like the teacher or you're whatever, doesn't mean you know more than everyone else necessarily or you have the right answer. But it's about that like intellectual process.
Something else that struck me is the GA perg work they did that summer happened to be on air quality issues.
Yeah.
Was that the spark for your environmental interests?
It was. So there's a day. So we were working to clean up air quality in Georgia. So Georgia had some of the worst air pollution in the country at the time, old coal-fired power plants that were allowed to put out unlimited amounts of smog-forming pollution under Clean Air Act. There's an effort to force them to clean up. Walking around hot in Georgia, really bad air quality, one day, and Atlanta's very hilly. So I get to the top of this hill, I knock on this woman's door, I start talking to her about air pollution and the power plants and asthma, and I had an asthma attack on her doorstep. And I recovered, I had my inhaler with me, which is not always usual. After I recovered and all, I think it was, you know, at the end of the summer, I mean, there were sort of two things. One, right, was like, this just very real realization that this isn't abstract, this is real people, and it's even my own life, and it's me, and I hadn't had asthma problems since I was like 6 or 7, it must be other people. Mm-hmm. And two, at the end of the summer, the politicians decided to allow these power plants to continue to basically spew unlimited amounts of this air pollution, and I was just like, I couldn't believe it. I was like, everyone I talked to wants clean air, right? Like, that doesn't really, like, it should just be everyone. There's not a lot of opposition, you know, from the public. So why are our politicians doing this thing? And so that really was my, like, two pieces that sort of politicized me of, like, a real visceral experience with the health impacts and this really visceral experience with the politics and the politicians sort of ignoring it, especially in a place like Georgia. And so I ended up running the Atlanta, Georgia campus office the following summer. And then when I graduated, I went to work for New Jersey PERG for a few years in New Jersey on clean energy policy.
So after going to St. John's in Maryland, is that what brought you to the Northeast?
It's like a job, yeah. I was trying to stay in the Mid-Atlantic because I knew I liked it. I didn't want to go somewhere really hot in the South, and I didn't want to go somewhere really cold in the North.
New Jersey fit the bill.
Yeah, and mostly, therefore, New Jersey fit the bill. And I stayed in New Jersey for 2 years, and I like New Jersey. It's a nice state.
Yeah.
I believe it.
So after running the Georgia canvassing office, the Atlanta canvassing office for PERG, what were you doing specifically in New Jersey?
So I was doing two things. I worked on our energy policy for New Jersey PERG. So my first year, I mostly helped pass the state's renewable electricity standard to get 20% clean energy by 2020. Mm. So it's back in 2005, 2006. And so I helped pass that law. I helped build the support for it, working with businesses, media, labor unions. So I did a bunch of that, and then I helped actually like do a bunch of the policy research around it so that it was the strongest regulation possible. So both sort of the politics and the substance of the policy. So we passed that in early 2006.
That's a huge victory.
It was. It was a big deal.
I mean, today, New Jersey is like the third most solarized state in the union, in part because of that legislation.
I know. Yeah. That was my first policy victory. I mean, that was really my first thing. And when I got there, like everyone, you know, it's New Jersey. They're pretty environmentally friendly, but it wasn't like a priority for the governors. I did all this work trying to get it like up the priority list by working with coalition partners and using the media to highlight the benefits, and we were able to give it on Governor Corzine at the time's agenda. And that was you're right, it's like everyone talks about New Jersey today, and sometimes I tell them, like, I actually helped, like, basically draft that law, which is really cool, when I was 22.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so then I worked on a bunch of, then after that I worked on a mixture of things, nothing as successful. Energy efficiency policy, and then closing Oyster Creek Nuclear Power Plant, which just finally announced it was going to close, so that took a while. Those were my two other big, like, policy areas that I worked on. And some other, like, random, like, ratepayer stuff. I mean, there's other stuff. And then in the summer times, I ran Canvas offices in North Jersey and in Central Jersey.
So it was a full-time job with CalPERT? It wasn't just, like, in the summertime canvassing? It was...
No, yeah, it was full year. We run a... So they run a two-year fellowship to train future organizers and advocates. And so it's, like, a mentorship program with a set of classroom-style trainings with a class of about 20 to 30 people, as well as like a mentor where you're doing the work side by side, doing the advocacy and the organizing work.
That sounds amazing. Tell me about building those coalitions with business and labor unions and writing the policy to help get that passed. What was that experience?
It was a little bit like getting thrown into the deep end. So, you know, you get like this classroom training and whatever, and maybe you think you can conquer the world. So,
when you say that, do you mean from college or do you mean New Jersey PERG gave you
classes? Yeah, so we did big national classroom style trainings. Mm. So we do like 2 weeks of training. It's a mixture of overviews and briefings and practice. And then, you know, as you're doing the work, you're working side by side with your staff director who acts as like a mentor. But like, it's still like, you're still like the youngest person in the room because you're like 22, right? And all these people have been doing this for like 20 years, right? And they're like, what the fuck do you know?
Yeah.
And sorry, I don't know. you know, and they're, you know, and I didn't have like an engineering degree, I had a philosophy degree, so really what the hell should I know? there's like a few memories that stick out in my mind. So I've been there for about 2 weeks, and we were going to this meeting, this presentation meeting for the like labor council, I think, for North or Central Jersey. So all the labor leaders. We're in the car, and my boss, Dina, turns to me, and she goes, oh, yeah, and are you ready to present at this thing that we're going to? I was like, I thought you were presenting about this thing. She's like, no, you're speaking, and then we're going to pass around the sheet for, like, coalition signups on the bill. And I was like, okay, so we get, so we practice and prep in the car for 30 minutes and whatever. So we get there, and we're, like, talking, I think it was to Rick, is the guy's name, and he was like, okay, so the order is, I'm going to kick us off, then you're going to speak, then the governor's going to speak. I'm like, wait, what? So literally, like, this is like 2 weeks in, it's me, it's the mayor of Edison, New Jersey, who introduced, you know, the governor, and then the governor. And like, wow. You know, but it was this moment, and like, a bunch of the labor leaders totally signed on and whatever. And then like, working with the clean energy businesses, you know, and like...
Do you remember what you said?
No.
Were you so nervous?
I mean, I'm sure I said something fine.
Yeah.
You know, and they're sort of all friends. It's Jersey, and they know Dina really well. And so I'm sure it was a little bit like, I'm sure it was not very good. You know, it's like 3 minutes, but, you know, I'm sure, whatever. So, you know, it's like this totally, like, thrown in the deep end and then hopefully having some success.
And you did.
Yeah, did. And then working with a bunch of the clean energy companies and, you know, I'm still friends with a lot of those folks today. I don't know, Pam, she runs like a electric vehicle nonprofit now in New Jersey. And, you know, they're, you know, so that was like the organizing side. My first press conference, I remember telling Dina she had to stay in the hallway. She couldn't come in for it.
Why?
Because it was nerve wracking. You don't want your boss standing there as you're speaking in front of the cameras for the first time. Like, that's crazy. You know, she lives in the hallway. She's very nice. I don't do that for my staff. They get to have me stand right there. You know, standing by, like, these labor leaders and clean energy business owners and elected officials, that was probably, like, month two. And then on the policy side, you know, working, I mean, I didn't know a lot, so I had to read a lot, and then talking through it a lot, it was sort of this group learning thing of, like, talking through it with Dina, of, like, and the rest of the experts at our team, of, like, what are the ramifications, and then we had really close ties. It was a regulation, so it wasn't legislation, and we had close ties to the regulators, so working with them and being in meetings with them, and mostly a lot of that was, like, yeah, piping up, but then also observing. And then I sort of remember one of the things we focused on was what's known as the alternative compliance payment. So if you don't meet the... You know, so the way the standard works is a utility company has to get a certain amount of energy from clean sources. The way they prove that is by showing they have a certain amount of renewable energy credits. If they don't meet that, they can also pay something called the alternative compliance payment, which then goes into money to encourage more clean energy growth. And the problem is that if the compliance payment is too low, that it creates a low market for the RECs, which hurts the payback period for clean energy solutions because it's cheaper for the companies just to buy these alternative compliance payments.
So in the first testimony on one of the public hearings, this was one of the real thing that needed to get fixed because it was set at like, I think like $100 or something.
So any fossil fuel companies just go ahead and pay that and not invest in
clean energy, right? And it goes back to clean energy, but it's not as good as like actually getting them, especially from like the health benefit side and the pollution reduction side. And so we really honed in on this idea that the alternative compliance payment needed to be $300, which we thought was like high enough that basically there's no way the RECs would ever reach it and it would make more sense. And so in the first public testimony, I helped organize the public hearing, like organize a lot of people. It was an official public hearing to go to it. Got a lot of the businesses and labor unions to speak, and I signed up, of course, to speak first, so I spoke. And, you know, it's sort of like, here's the big vision and why we need this, and then here's the policy thing you have to fix. And after I sat down, this guy, Eric Stiles, who got up at New Jersey Audubon, and he said, ditto what Adam said. And then the guy at Sierra Club, Jeff Tittle, got up and said, ditto what Adam said. And then, you know, whatever. And so I went, and it's like, oh, they all just trusted that I knew the policy thing well enough and I'd moved them along enough. And so it sort of also taught me this thing that all the things I learned about, like, I can figure out the policy piece if I spend enough time on it, was true, which was pretty comforting because it's sort of what I think I got out of school more than anything else. And I think actually what people should get out of school more than anything else, I think more and more people don't use their degrees in their day-to-day job most of the time. Mm-hmm. So getting this ability, where did I put that water? To getting the ability to just learn things and be able to figure things out on your own is really just valuable.
That's right.
You know, and then I had that experience, of course.
Those are pretty powerful moments. Yeah. So maybe you can take a quick break here before we transition into how you came to Philadelphia.
Sure.
And then what your visions are for the city.
That sounds great.